Hey everybody, welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name is Bina 007. I will be your host today. And I am super excited to reintroduce many of you to an original, an OG Vassals of Kingsgrave awesome lady. This is No True Lady, Julia. Jules, do you want to introduce yourself to the people? Tell them where you are, what you're about.
Well, I mean, I did. I was one of the first vassals. That's true. You know, the offshoot. I don't know how many people still remember this. You know, the offshoot of the original Song of Ice and Fire podcast. The idea was a bunch of us listeners were like, hey, we want to talk stuff too, but not just Game of Thrones stuff. We want to talk about all sorts of media. And a bunch of us met that way and have become friends over the years. And, you know, I pop in now periodically just because of life stuff. But a lot of us keep in touch, you know, just through Facebook or Instagram or what have you. And it's really nice to have this group of people around the world who, you know, now and then it's like, I really need to talk about this movie. And you can do that.
And especially when there's so few places on the internet where you can disagree agreeably, right? Uh-huh. Where it's a safe, gorgeous public space. And the genesis for today's episode is that I had, I think, posted something about Napoleon, the new Ridley Scott movie, went to see it opening day, big IMAX screen. I'm a huge Napoleon Battle of Waterloo nerd. And I was there were bits of the film I loved, bits I didn't love so much. And then you insta messaged me and you were like, I loved it. And I was immediately like, okay, now we need to talk. Now we need to discuss how we feel about this film. So we're going to do the usual thing, listeners. We will give lemon cake ratings. We're going to get into what we loved, what we didn't love. We are going to have spoilers because I think this is discussing, you know, 200 plus year old history. And also it's hard to discuss how we do or don't like Ridley Scott's take without talking about what it maybe is or isn't doing with the history. So Julia, why don't you start by telling me your first impressions of this film? And are you a big Ridley Scott and or Napoleon fan going into this? What was your hype level on entering the cinema?
My hype level was very high. Not like Star Wars high per se, not like, you know, new season of House of the Dragon high, but like pretty high. I'd say let's say lemon cake ratings, because we do the five, right? So I'd say my hype level going in was a 4, and coming out I was still a 4. So getting that rating out of the way, I am a huge history nerd, and I'd say one of my favorite periods of European history and UK history is that Regency / Napoleonic era, where, you know, when we're going from roughly what hits, like, I'd say mid to late 1700s, which of course encompasses the American Revolution. And my family, if you want to talk about OGs, my family has been here for all of that, you know, American colonial history. Oh, yeah.
You're like the OGs of the United States.
Yes. I mean, I am from a Mayflower family. But I mean, a lot of people are. And it also, like, now we you know, just like with this movie, we think about, what does that mean? What does that actually mean? So I'm a big fan of that era of history, and then going, you know, from that, the Enlightenment into this era of early revolutions into, you know, the Napoleonic era. So when I heard Ridley Scott, who, of course, I'm a huge fan of Gladiator, you know, that movie just sort of changed the trajectory of my life in a lot of ways, I think, just in terms of what I've come to expect out of historical epics. When I heard, oh, he's doing Napoleon and he's doing it with Joaquin Phoenix, I thought, yes, but then also, well, he's the age now that Napoleon was when he died. So I was thinking, like, are they going to do de-aging? Are they going to do makeup? And it's like, no, they just had him do it. And it worked just fine.
So this is where we're going to, I think, disagree. Because, I mean, I love Joaquin Phoenix. I was excited when he was cast. I was a bit nervous when I heard he was doing it, because, as you say, he's the age when Napoleon died. And I thought, maybe that's okay if they mostly focus on the climactic final battle of Waterloo and, you know, the hubris.
Yeah, the end of his life.
Turned to ashes, right? But no, this really is, I mean, maybe to explain to the listener if you haven't seen it, this film really does, quite impressively over 2.5 hour theatrical running time, effectively do his entire career. So we meet him as a young gunnery sergeant in Paris, seeing the beheading of Marie Antoinette. You see his rise to power, becoming a general, and then making himself emperor. amazing victories at the Battle of Austerlitz, defeating the First Alliance, and then coming back from exile to again lead the French army, ultimately to defeat at Waterloo. So, you know, he really does look very old and weary in the opening stages. And maybe we can get into it more. But to me, I mm-hmm. felt that the story for me, the trajectory of Napoleon for me is one of hope denied. That he burst mm-hmm. onto the flames of revolutionary, radical Europe, you know, wake of the French Revolution. The Enlightenment on horseback is how he was described mm-hmm. by, you know, by one person. And I think that he's got to look romantic and young and dynamic and charismatic. And you have to believe why people coming out of the Terror would put their hopes in him. You have to believe why he would inspire Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and all these people through history. He would inspire them with this hope of rational, humanistic government. And then to see power corrupt and him seize ever more power, become dictatorial, become sort of an invader, and then finally sort of be crushed. I just felt I needed an early era Napoleon who was visually more arresting and looked less tired.
So how are you viewing
the Joaquin Phoenix of the early parts of the film? Because he worked for you.
Well, so I'm going to sort of step back and say how I sort of made the decision to go into the movie overall, which was having my opinions about the way I wish they had done things differently on one side, but then I had seen, like, I don't like to read reviews and whatnot for movies before I go in, because I want to be as spoiler free and as pure an experience as possible. But I did see the one thing about Ridley Scott basically telling the critics of, you know, the historical inaccuracies to shut up, nerds. And I just sort of kept that in the back of my head. Shut up, nerds.
I think it was ruder. He was telling historians to quote unquote get a life. And I kind of agree with him. I don't need my historical fiction, whether written or on screen, to match history at all. I just need it to work within the confines of the movie I'm in. So I just found it hard to believe he'd be that inspiring when he was that schlubby and world weary. But
What I wanted to say about the age thing is that, like, my thought was, you know, and it's even from the first trailers, was they should have done as they did in House of the Dragon and had a younger actor play him, and then we would just have a very abrupt switch to Joaquin Phoenix, like, halfway or even three-quarters, you know, two-thirds through. And then we would get that experience of, you know, seeing at the end, as you said, at, you know, at this, you know, when things have gone too far, and then he would be world-weary, and then, you know, then it would make a lot more sense.
Yeah, or anti-age, right? De-age with technology. I think either of those would have worked. And it's a shame, because it is a great performance. I mean, I think he's an amazing Napoleon. I think it was almost worse for Josephine, right? Because part of the, or maybe the only plot line really that Josephine has, I think she's a little bit hard done by, is Napoleon marries this woman very quickly who is, I think, 4 or 5 years his senior in real life. And evidently when he's just a general, it doesn't matter that maybe she's older. She already has children from the first marriage.
Yeah.
Married to an aristo, but it becomes problematic that she's not giving him a child when he makes himself an emperor. Because, of course, when you become a king or an emperor, as Marie Antoinette well knows, being able to provide an heir becomes key. And I felt, again, if that's going to be the heart of your emotional story, that this is the love of his life, but he has to cast her aside to marry a young royal princess to provide a son, even though he still loves her. I felt that would have been more credible on screen had Vanessa Kirby, who is stunning and young and younger than Joaquin Phoenix, they didn't age her at all in the film. And so all these, like, it didn't feel like, I felt that it was left hanging, like, so why isn't she having a kid? Like, because presumably at some point the mother-in-law walks in and says, you know, she's past the age of childbearing. And you're like, well, she looks like she's 28. How did you find Josephine in terms of both them focusing on that love story, Vanessa Kirby's portrayal? How did you feel about all things Josephine?
Oh, well, I loved it. I mean, from the moment she appeared on the film, I was like, oh yeah, I'm 100%, you know, on board with her. You know, I link up, you know, obviously my life is not nearly as, you know, dramatic or fraught as hers, but, you know, part of, and being a, you know, about my tragic backstory, as do many, you know, of the OG Vassals members, but, you know, having gone through a divorce and having a young child and having to grapple with these thoughts of, you know, do I just find a guy on an app and remarry and, you know, make my life presumably easier that way, having to go it alone in a pretty, you know, in a lot of ways, obviously not as harsh as revolutionary France, but still a pretty harsh world.
And some of the same dynamics, right? I mean, because the Josephine we're presented with, why she's so compelling is she is a survivor and she's very pragmatic. She's a woman who was married to this horrific aristo, although he's not shown. He's executed. Yeah. She thinks she's going to get guillotined. She frankly tells Napoleon, I was trying to get pregnant to avoid being executed. So do I need to go through my indiscretions in prison, or are you cool with that and we can take it as read? Mm-hmm. So she's a woman who has done stuff to survive. And I think it's quite clear in the film that where he is absolutely infatuated with her from the first. And I think she does fall for him in the end. At first, I think it is quite a pragmatic, this is revolutionary France. I'm going to potentially starve her. I've got kids to feed. This is an up-and-coming guy. I can give myself to him and I will have position. And it changes from that. And that's a wonderful evolution. But I think it's a really beautifully raw, vulnerable, but also quite strong portrayal. Like, she's very strong in that choice, which I love, you know.
And I think that her arc and Vanessa Kirby's portrayal of Josephine, that to me felt very genuine. That felt truthful to me, because I have read a biography of Josephine and I did know about how, you know, she was a minor aristocrat and, you know, and her, you know, like as you said, her husband was executed. And you know, that's okay. He was a jerk. She was in prison, and the situation was that, at, you know, they were just basically like, you know, not quite picking names out of a hat, but, you know, almost at that point. And everyone who was left alive at the end of the day, just they basically would have an orgy, you know, because they were so relieved to still be alive. And then B, if you could get pregnant, you could forestall your execution until the child was born. So the whole idea was that, you know, continuing to buy more time and try to wait out the terror. And that is more than likely something that she did do, you know. So I felt like them bringing that up first thing was like, oh, okay, awesome. This is really good. And then her kids were right there. And yeah, they were right there. And I think that is one place where I really need the director's cut, is that her kids were a much more prominent part of the story. They were there at the beginning. And then at the end, they pop back up. And I had to be like, wait, are those her kids? Oh, those are her kids.
I know. There was this adult woman who I thought was just a friend or a maid. And it was the daughter.
Yeah.
And it is worth telling the listener that there's going to be, this was a 2.5-hour cut. And Ridley Scott, which I love, unlike Martin Scorsese, he thinks he just should sit in a cinema for like 4 hours and end, acknowledges the restrictions of the human body. So he fights very hard to get this to 2.5 hours in the cinema. But there's going to be a 4-hour plus release on Apple TV at some point.
So. There is. Oh my God, give it to me right now. I knew there was going to be a director's cut. I was anticipating, oh, that's usually what, 20, 30 more minutes. Really? It's going to be.
It's just over 4 hours. It's going to be on Apple TV, maybe Christmas or the New Year. And that was, you know, he's. We're going to get so much more relationship color in that, and I'm really looking forward to it. Definitely.
No, we'll get to what I'm hoping to see in the director's cut, because that has also been on the top of my mind. But back to Josephine and the kids. The thing is that the Napoleon did adopt them, Eugène and Hortense. It's a much prettier name, and so is Eugene. They're much prettier in French. He had a really good relationship with both the kids, and the kids ultimately helped keep Napoleon and Josephine together multiple times through their marriage. They were the ones who came to it, which obviously was not their place at all as children, but they came in constantly to be the peacemakers between their mom and stepdad.
Yeah, and what this film does capture very nicely is just how volatile that relationship was between two incredibly strong, talented people. You know, Napoleon is, you know, a visionary military leader. I don't agree with his latter politics, but, you know, within very short order, he instituted proper constitutional reform in France. He put down the Code Napoleon. I mean, like, this is a very talented and driven guy. But she herself is an incredibly strong woman. And you have a lot of scenes which are just them in dialogue. and kind of bickering, arguing. And there's a lot of kind of verbal power play about who is it who has enhanced the other's life? Is it that Napoleon saved Josephine, or is it that she saved him because he was just this provincial guy from Corsica and she taught him, you know, sort of courtly manners? And it's really like, in some respects, and this is, you know, Game of Thronesy a little bit, like the Cersei Jaime dynamic of who's really in control, who's really in in the powerful position here. She is not a kept woman by any means. No. She is very much a power player in this relationship.
Yeah, and you know, to along those lines, her home Malmaison, that was hers. That she did quote unquote borrow the money from Napoleon to buy it, but that was her house. Is what the real site, the real historic site is featured in the movie. Like that is the real Malmaison they use, obviously, but that was her house, which is wild to think about at that time.
The other thing that's wild to me is that even as Napoleon's marrying the little feeble Austrian princess to have a little son, I mean, he is still writing these passionate love letters to her, and he takes his son to see her. It's almost like he still needs her benediction at every stage of his life. And I think Vanessa Kirby, she's given very few lines, at least in this cut of the film, but particularly in the divorce scene, you see the kind of the conflict, the heartbreak. She knows he still loves her, but she also, her pride is piqued that he is passing her over for a son. And it's so, I mean, her performance, there's so much complexity in her physicality, in her face. It's really something.
Though that's something that really drew me in with her performance was the face. How I described it as she's, you know, a lot of scenes she's looking both very scared but also very alluring.
Yes.
And it's like, and that terror, you know, that is just sort of intrinsic to, you know, like her position and what she's been through and what she's, and also the fact that Napoleon was really not a fun guy to be around a lot of the times. And we only saw a little bit of his physical outburst, you know, what that one moment that really shocked me when he first comes back from Egypt, when he first finds out that she's cheating. And he was legitimately in the real history, he was an absolute mess over that.
Absolutely.
And he's questioning her maid, and he smashes the glass, and like that was a really shocking moment. But it's like, that's right, that's him, that's who he was. And then again, when he slaps her during the divorce ceremony, I mean, that is who Napoleon was, you know, and how they keep describing him as a brute throughout the film. And I really think that that's something we're going to get to see more of during in the director's cut, because he really did fly against polite society, what was left of it after the revolution. But, you know, he was a really coarse person. And I do want to talk a little bit at some point here about my thoughts about Napoleon as a person and as a diagnosis, if you will. But
let's do that now, because I think there's sort of three dimensions we can talk about. We can talk about Napoleon in terms of his personal relationships with Josephine and as a man. Then I think there's Napoleon the legislator, which we get very little of here, but I think it's worth talking a bit about his political rise. And then finally, Napoleon, the military genius. So I think those are the three dimensions we can discuss. So let's get into your feeling about certainly the Napoleon that we are presented by Scott, or whatever, what you feel Ridley Scott's thesis is as to Napoleon, because, you know, this is a man who has more books written about him than anyone else. I mean, like, a lot of people have
more than Hitler.
Exactly. Yeah, people have used him.
And everyone knows who he is to this day. France still runs on a lot of the frameworks, the governmental frameworks that he set up.
And not just France, but all of the countries he conquers where he imposed the Code Napoleon. Really? So Italian law, a lot of those countries, the bedrock of their law is Napoleonic code. And it's what makes, in a way, a certain logic to the European Union of bringing those countries together, because actually their codification is, thanks Napoleon, arguably that was the first European Union. So his wild legacy is immense, absolutely immense.
So I have been working my way through a biography of Napoleon over the past few months in anticipation of the movie coming out. And something, you know, we do have all this wonderful documentation of his life, which is great. And the thing that got me thinking in this direction was the description of how in meetings he would fidget, but he would fidget in specific ways. Like he would just have like a knife, a dagger, and just repeatedly just you know, stab the arm of a chair with it. Or he would do this weird thing of he would have blank pieces of paper. And as he was talking, everyone was talking, he would slowly just like ink the whole piece of paper black, like with some kind of a brush, but just like gradually just go over the whole page. And my thought was, okay, this man had ADHD and was probably also autistic.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to diagnose back in the past, but I think you're probably right. Yeah. Certainly on the ADHD, there's a lot, you read his biographies and see all his physical mannerisms and in a way, yeah, I mean, you could also argue maybe manic depressive. I mean, he whipped himself up into real highs and then, I mean, came crashing down as well, which maybe is part of why he was so good at military victory.
And also part of that with when you come, you know, with ADHD is just, that's something I have, and also, you know, having to help my son navigate through it because genetics, I gave it to him, oops, that you do have to sort of like stimulate yourself because there's certain, you know, aspects of chemistry and whatnot missing in your brain. And you do you have to stimulate, you have to stim. That's why basically medical meth works for people with brains like ours. It makes us feel normal as opposed to, well, I mean, if you take too much, you're not going to be normal, but you have to do that to yourself in order to get to some level of quote unquote normal base functioning. So, but also probably just because it was so hard for him to cope with the fact that he had these differences, him also having, you know, bipolar manic depression, totally within the realm of possibility as well. But that's what stood out to me. And also his lack of quote unquote social graces. I mean, that's something that when you have these conditions, you struggle with throughout your life. Socially, I know I have. And for him, he just didn't care because spending so much time in the field, it didn't matter as much. But, you know, apparently he was someone, you put him into a setting of polite society. And like, he did always wear the damn hat. He did always have that damn hat on. That's another aspect that also very much hit me as you know, that combination like ADHD autism of just like, no, I need to do my thing. This is my thing. And he made himself into an icon.
Yeah,
he
did absolutely. That.
And you're the British people, your folk, and you know, well, also mildly, but they did their part too. And we see a little bit of that in the movie as he sees propaganda against himself. And, you know, that was a huge thing that happened. And the whole thing with his height, which they just never even talked about, which was good because, you know, that was a propaganda thing more than likely. Yeah. Like a lot of what we think we know about Napoleon, that very like surface level pop culture stuff that we all get exposed to was part of British propaganda against him.
And vice versa, right? I mean, it's kind of amazing how different countries and, you know, people love the great man theory of history and people have put him into great works of literature. I mean, one of the most amazing is Tolstoy's War and Peace, which takes us into the mind of both Napoleon but also the Russian general who, I would argue, beat him at Borodino, or at least halted his advance and made it possible for Russia to survive. And, you know, in that, Napoleon very much sees himself as an instrument of destiny. He's very much a great man. But he is punctured. He is punctured in that. And unsurprisingly, because it's the Russian view. Contrast it with Victor Hugo. When Victor Hugo, French, writes about Napoleon many years later, he almost depicts Napoleon as a man so powerful, so amazing that it took, you know, all the countries of Europe and God and destiny to bring him down at Waterloo. Victor Hugo cannot bring himself to admit that Wellington and Blücher, mere men, mere mortals, a Britain, a Prussian general, brought down Napoleon. He has to almost put it down to divine, kind of the gods left him and so he fell. And I find it hilarious. And you see it in contemporary reviews of this film. The French have, in general, been more savage towards this film because they see Ridley Scott as a Brit, as being partisan and therefore being more favorable to the Duke of Wellington. So this yeah. kind of propagandizing on each side cracks mm-hmm. me up. And it is amazing when you go to contemporary Paris and you see, you know, all these sort of shrines to Napoleon. You can go to Les Invalides, and he's still seen as this amazing military general, and the rest of the world's like, but he was a tyrant, right? And maybe it's the same way that we argue over the legacy of Julius Caesar and all of these very complex men who were simultaneously militarily phenomenal, but also politically horrific. And but you're right, mm-hmm. this is very, very contested ground. Shall we move to the politics, of which there's not much, right? I mean, we see the kind of the coup d'etat, and it's played for laughs. How did you find, yes. I mean, basically, the way the film shows Napoleon is, you know, France is falling apart, it has descended into terror, the revolution has turned to terror, to sort of brutal, dictatorial, horrific guillotining. People are looking to Napoleon to maybe get involved and show some leadership, and he's literally falling asleep at a meeting. Finally, he takes over, but it's almost played as a Monty Python does Napoleon. I mean, like, they're sort of scuffling, and I guess some historians would say actually that's pretty much what it was. It was pretty hilariously ridiculous.
Yeah, no,
but it felt like, what's that amazing Hulu show? Is it The Great, about Catherine the Great? I felt that coup d'etat scene could have come from that show. How did you find it?
Yeah, it was still suitably intense. You definitely did feel that level of danger there. But that is, my understanding is that is pretty much what happened, is that there are some conflicting reports in history, like, was his life ever really in danger? Was this, you know, stagecraft, as with, you know, the little scene with his brother Lucien, aka Laris Strong, and that moment of, I'll kill my brother if he's going to betray the revolution, and then just gives them this look of like, well, what else am I going to say? Like, go along with it. And then, you know, him walking back up the stairs that he just tumbled down, which I think is a really nice, you know, a really nice a visual moment. And then saying, well, shall we put it to a vote? So I was fine with all that. I thought it was a lot of fun. I think.
But it shows you very much that from the start, even though he achieved a lot of humanist, amazing sort of liberalizing reforms, the power was from the very first moment seized at the barrel of a gun, right? I mean, let's put it to a vote when you're surrounded by personally loyal cadre of people armed with rifles. To me, I wish there had been more politics, and I think we lost Napoleon the legislator, Napoleon the reformer, Napoleon then the tyrant, and I'm hoping that some of that is what appears in the four-hour cut. This was a very frustrating part of the film, and I thought, actually, he was politically incredibly savvy. So if literally the big action set piece of his politics is him sort of basically tumbling down some stairs and sort of like this sort of comedy, sort of moronic coup d'etat, then I think that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it less as being played for laughs and more as like just showing the real human drama, the, you know, that you're down in the mud. You're down. This is what happened, you know, like this is
it's what politics is.
The movie was very visceral in a lot of ways. Like at the beginning, so just a little background on me, you know, like, well, my family and I will, like, you know, we'll suggest movies to each other, TV shows, obviously, as most families do. And for my dad, my nurture horse girl, he any movie, TV show, he'll say his favorite characters. He just loves horses. And so at the very beginning, you know, when he's I forget the name of that one fortress that they're taking back over. And
Toulon. And
his, yes, I know it started with a T. And his horse just eats it in the chest with a cannonball, extremely graphically. I was like, well, my dad can't watch this. And I do think that the movie did a good job consistently just really showing that very visceral, gritty, you know, people are fighting in the mud of that era and of that place and time. You know, from the beginning, like, you know, showing the execution of Marie Antoinette, which a couple of historical inaccuracies, you know, again, I have to do a quick aside, Bina, because I'm also a big Marie Antoinette head. And I understand why Ridley made these choices, but I had to, again, put aside that side, because the thing is, we know what her execution was like, and she was
the idea of her running around with this powdered wig, I mean, it was just so absurd. Yeah. I hate stuff like
It did her she was not ripped from the arms of her children. And the thing is, they'd already been separated for quite some time in captivity, unfortunately. Yeah, no, that she had not seen her kids for quite some time before the execution, sadly. Her hair was pulled under a bonnet. And yes, she was, and she wasn't really looking around. She was looking straight ahead as she walked up to the scaffold.
She was actually apparently she was incredibly dignified in death. And
yes,
although in some respects, quite a silly little girl when she became queen, that apparently had her period of incarceration, also true of the king, apparently, that they really matured and achieved gravitas. And by the end, I think the crowds were very ambiguous about what was happening, because they recognized in these people the injustice, and that they had risen above the petty brutality of what was being done to them. But so it's yet another issue that I have with this film, for sure, is I don't mind putting Marie Antoinette in there to show, because it was really the start of his career. I get it.
Yeah, you've got to. Yeah, it was. Yeah, the book ending there. Yes.
But at least have the respect to show it, because it could have been equally dramatic. I think it would have achieved what Ridley wanted it to achieve.
Yes.
Even if he had respected the truth of that moment and just put Napoleon into that moment.
And just a little bit of tweaking. And also, she was incredibly ill by that time. She was probably dying of cancer anyway, because she always had, you know, issues with her, you know, reproductive health. And I had read in a biography that she was having a lot of uterine bleeding. So she probably had some kind of cancer down there by that point anyway. And she was going to die soon anyway. So, you know, she again went to her death with a great deal of dignity and also a bit of relief. And that she got up onto the scaffold and she tripped over the executioner's foot a little bit. And her last words were, "I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to do it." Which is really, if you want to talk about summing up an entire life in one sentence.
Exactly.
You know, and they could have, you know, but, you know, again, you know, with Ridley saying, you know, go get a life to us history nerds. I just decided to be like, okay, this is how a lot of people did perceive her execution. This is the feeling, the spirit, if not the letter, that a lot of people came away with. So that's
I think what it gets really right, and what sort of George R. R. Martin also shows in his books, is how these things become iconic and become memed in their own time. So the idea that she's executed in a certain way, and then we're going to see the puppet show with the dwarves and people, like, you know, taking the piss out of it. And I think, you know, George does that very well with Mamas, and how these big great man events get interpreted by the ordinary working classes and sort of repurposed as cheap entertainment and caricature, I think actually does come across really well in here.
I agree that was a very important aspect that did unfortunately get pushed to the side. And because of that, I felt like things did move a little too fast in that regard, and that I did get a little confused about, like, wait, who's that? Where's that? Where's Lucien? Where's their other friend? Where is everybody? You know, and because there were a lot of people, involved, and that's where, when they, you know, give the little, you know, title card on the screen of who this person is, it's like, hey, there's Talleyrand. Okay. All right. You know, I it's like, in that kind of respect, it's like, fine, walk me through it. Tell me where we are.
That's because we know who these people are. I mean, I was wondering, how are people going to interpret this film who don't have a big understanding of Napoleon? Because it goes so fast. There are so many people who are on screen very fleetingly. Are they going to have any clue what's going on? Because I think even for me, with, you know, and you, like, knowing what's going on, I felt like I was just, like, clinging on for dear life to kind of, like, you know, figure out where I was in this thing.
Well, I mean, and also, you know, again, with these little artistic choices, creating, you know, either taking you out of it or creating confusion, like, at the time of Napoleon seizing power, they were still doing the revolutionary calendar, where they had changed the names of the months and all that, and it was the Brumaire coup, and they gave they had given the name in the conventional calendar that date. And it's like, wait, is that where we are? Is that what this is? How am I supposed to know? Because he's not telling us what they called it at the time, you know? And so it's just choices like that, that again, took me out of it and made me feel like, okay, if this is confusing for me, a person who, I mean, obviously I don't have a encyclopedic knowledge of it, but like, I know the general, you know, moments of how things went. I know the general sequence. If I'm being like, wait, is that where we are now? Yes, someone who doesn't know is going to be lost.
Yeah, I agree. But I think that will all resolve in the 4-hour cut. I think some of that frenetic history is one damn thing after another and just kind of rattling along will probably calm itself in the 4 hours. So, yes. And I always feel, especially with Ridley Scott, you know, some directors, I don't like their extended cuts. I find them indulgent. But I think with Ridley Scott, he typically does get better in the extended cut. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Like, for example, I've never seen the extended cut of Kingdom of Heaven, but apparently that kind of like fixes everything about that movie.
Kingdom of Heaven is amazing, right? Because I have seen the extended cut and it's a phenomenal film, but was absolutely, you know, traduced by critics and at the box office. And I think it just needed that. It needed the space. Okay, should we get to the battles? Should we get to what people come to the film for?
Well, one last thing I want to say about the politics is my hope for the extended cut is we'll get a nice montage sequence of like getting some enlightenment stuff and Napoleon like actually seeing him building some of these ideas that have become that framework that exists to this day. Like that would
I'm not sure we are, because I think that would contradict Ridley Scott's depiction of Napoleon as a brute and this kind of, like, you know, this guy who's standing in the corner of the room mumming and neighing at his wife because he wants to fuck her. I mean, I think it's sort of, I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm a bit nervous that we're not going to get politics. I think other things will breathe, but I think this is a very, in a sense, it's not an evolving portrait of Napoleon. Napoleon is a thing and he stays that thing to the end. And I think Napoleon's life showed huge evolution. So that's, I don't know. We'll see. Maybe we can do a quick podcast when the extended cut comes out and discuss it.
That would be nice. I would be down for that. But yeah. I mean, just like throwing in just like some aside moments just to flesh out, because, you know, one of the reasons why we still talk about Napoleon today is because he was such a complex person. You know, like, we've already tried to put some modern labels on, like, was he autistic? Was he bipolar? Was he, you know? But like at the same time, like when you in the past, when you have these sorts of things coalesce in a person and that they find their place in the moment of history, amazing stuff happens, you know, and I want to be able to see all those things because an age crystallized in a person.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about, you know, this conflict between polite society versus the coming modern era. It wasn't just about the wars. It was about the Enlightenment and this idea of government and nations and you know, the way we think about countries and whatnot now. That was there. That was an important part of it. Anyway, okay, off my soapbox, down
I agree with you, though. I mean, we're both on the soapbox. I think we're in it together. All right then. I mean, obviously Ridley Scott has made a decision in getting to 2.5 hours that he's going to focus on Josephine, and then he's going to focus on the battles, and everything else is just scaffolding upon which to hang those two main storylines. And I think by and large that works as a choice.
Yes, for this part. I agree.
The battles, it's amazing with Napoleon, right? Because you've got to figure out what you're going to show. I mean, hilariously, probably for shits and giggles, he does show Napoleon like bombarding the pyramids. That did not happen, let's be clear. The four battles that he chooses to show, the first in some depth is the Battle of Toulon, which arguably made his name. And he's basically capturing a fort on a port city that basically enables the French to get rid of the English blockade. And you see this sort of comedic hatred that Napoleon has for the British and their navy all the way through. So that's the first big battle that's shown. We then have a very big battle sequence at the Battle of Austerlitz in 1805, which one could argue is not just only his most impressive tactical accomplishment, but one of the most impressive tactical battles in history, where he defeats the combined army of Austria and Russia. It's called the Battle of the Three Emperors, because three emperors are on the field And I think that is just so visually arresting and beautiful. It's worth going to the cinema just to see that. And it's shown in some depth. Like you get the idea of why this worked tactically and Napoleon's genius in pulling it off. We then get the third battle, which is a very, very brief sketch of the Battle of Borodino. Incredibly brief, but it's the still photo you'll all have seen of Napoleon charging into battle with his saber outstretched. Obviously didn't happen. Generals did not charge into battle. I think this was probably Ridley Scott wisely not showing it because it's so well filmed in Sergei Bondarchuk's War and Peace. So it's almost like if someone else has filmed this in great detail with the entire Red Army reenacting it for you, then there's no point even trying to do it again. So basically Toulon's big, Austerlitz is really big, Borodino is very tiny. And then finally you get the Battle of Waterloo, which is done, I mean, it's a huge battle, but it's done in a little bit of depth, not as much as Austerlitz, but it's done fairly well. And you have Rupert Everett as Duke of Wellington, which is hilarious. And I think that's done pretty well too. So I would say Austerlitz and Waterloo are done fairly well. I think this is the aspect of the film I liked most. I thought it was well crafted. And I think Austerlitz in particular, I think, is one of the most visually arresting things in the film. You know, the troops. The enemy troops going on to what they think is land to escape, but it's really ice and being bombarded from underneath and falling through the cracks. I think it's just very, very moving. How did you find the military aspect of this film?
Well, that was, I think, one of the big draws of the film. I mean, Ridley Scott does big battles well.
Yes.
You know, I mean, like that was, you know, going, let's go back to Gladiator 20 years ago, which is when Joaquin Phoenix would have been the right age to play Napoleon. But anyway, I'm also a big Roman history nerd, and watching what he put there for the battles, you know, of the legions going in at the beginning against the quote unquote barbarian hordes, I was like, oh my God, this is good. This is pretty accurate. So I knew going in that the battles were going to be really good. And I think so the combination of what he and the fact this is, you know, all these CG computer graphics have been at this point, you know, gotten to a point where they're amazing, but also used and abused in a lot of other films. But the fact that it was used to actually portray the scale of we're talking about not thousands, not tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people involved in some of these battles. And again, just the brutality, you know, like, you know, back when the horse eats it in the chest with the cannonball, which then he gives to Lucienne and says, send it to mother. Like that was the moment I knew, like, oh, okay, this is going to get gory. And indeed it did.
And it should, because you need to see what war means.
Exactly.
Particularly in this era, you know, Waterloo was this tiny, tiny battlefield and an incredibly high density of death. And probably the most savage thing until the American Civil War, which was then the most savage thing until the First World War. And I think it does a disservice if you just see guys in cute uniforms looking really fit, riding into battle on horseback. You have to see the mud and the blood and the death. Otherwise, it's just some kind of, you know, war porn in a way, right? And this, I think he did a really good job of showing the reality of what this would mean.
Yes. And also at the beginning, he suppresses the Royalist rebellion, and that first line of people standing in front just turns into goo.
And your legs blown off, and it was And in a way, it justifies the depiction of Napoleon as this brute, because you've got to think, this is a guy who serially for 20 years has ordered people to do this.
He's the only person, but, you know, still.
Yeah, but he is one, and he's very good at it. And then when he's exiled on Elba at first, he makes a choice to come back to France. And even when he comes back to France, he makes a choice to lead another army to Waterloo. And, you know, there are huge amounts of people who lose their life because of what this guy did. And actually, one of the things I disagreed with at the end is they put up, which I think with good intention, a list of casualties, like these are the people who died in his battles, and it culminates in Waterloo, which is huge. And I just sort of feel like, yes, but those early battles were battles of defense. Those early battles were France has had a revolution, and now everyone is pissed off and declared war against. So I don't blame him for those casualties. He's fighting a war of defense of his country against Austria and England and the other imperial powers. So I think it's a bit unfair to conflate those death tolls with what I would call offensive wars of choice, like coming back to France and then engaging in Waterloo. That that's the choice that Napoleon made. And those people are only dead because Napoleon, through vanity, decided to come back to France. So I would have stood out those death tolls, because to me, I'd never blame him for the first half of his career, but the second half of his career, I do.
Okay, no, that's an interesting. I had not thought about it like that. And you know, again, that is why Waterloo is a word for it means defeat in our modern lexicon. It means also the worst possible defeat you can possibly suffer. You know, it's ego death. It's the end of everything. Because it was.
Really hilarious, and what I think the film captures very well, is Napoleon did not get it. He's still, even when captured, I mean, after the Battle of Waterloo, for months he was on the run in France and went to La Rochelle, finally gets on a boat and makes it to England. And he genuinely believes he's such a great man, and he's a bit of an Anglophile, and the British will allow him to retire to a little cottage in the Cotswolds, and he'll become a locally famous. I mean, this the delusion of the man. And, you know, of course, Wellington never met him, but I think there's something very truthful in that scene where Wellington has to say, no, mate, you're getting shipped off to an island in the middle of bloody nowhere. You know, like, you're not going to live out your days as some laird in a big country estate. I think he didn't understand his defeat. You know, he didn't get it.
Well, I mean, because we see him going from, you know, a person who, you know, obviously was not built like other men, you know, which is very much true, and just getting to the point where he believed his own hype. And we see that in humanity throughout history, people who get to the point where they believe their own hype. The aforementioned Julius Caesar, Trump, for what it's worth. But can I just quickly say, I loved Wellington. Oh my God. With that gorgeous navy blue cape draped over the back of the horse. Like, he just came in and was just like, oh yeah, oh yeah, Napoleon's about to eat shit. Oh my God.
I love it too. I mean, it's very not historically correct, but yeah. Rupert Everett is clearly just having so much bloody fun.
Oh my God, yes, you're right.
With he has aged, but also aged up, I think, which is weird because they were both very young. I mean, they were both, you know, sort of what, mid-40s at Waterloo, and they both look much older. But he has this, you see I think what's truthful and historically correct in this incorrect portrayal is you get this idea that Wellington, while also very vainglorious, and he then, you know, had political aspirations, became prime minister, right? But he is in a category difference from Napoleon, because he can help himself. He has self-discipline.
Exactly.
And at one point he looks down his telescope at Napoleon when he's falling for his trap of launching a cavalry charge and says, you just can't help yourself. And I think that's absolutely, that just sums up the entire film, that Napoleon is a man who just can't help himself. He's just a greedy fucker. Whether it's for sex, for food, for this lamb chop, for conquering Russia, he cannot help himself. And Wellington, by contrast, has that moderation. And I think it gets that very, very right.
And you know, going back to, you know, whatever possible diagnosis, whatever Napoleon had going on, I mean, impulse control. That is a hallmark of ADHD and, you know, and also autism. This is a guy who did start out with good intentions, with a really amazing vision, born of his time, but then really can, you know, crystallized within him as a person. That's my personal belief of Napoleon. And then he just took it too far. He just took it too damn far.
Just couldn't help himself. He came back. He should never have come back. And I think, you know, that there was his undoing.
But also, given that era, given the way Europe was set up, that kings were still absolute, or were still at least very powerful, that it, you know, the way things were, where was the stopping point going to be anyway?
There is no stopping point. I mean, Britain's the only constitutional monarchy, really, at this point, or maybe Netherlands, the incipient Netherlands. I mean, you know, the Austrian and the Russian emperors are absolute monarchs at this point. Yeah. When Napoleon makes himself an absolute emperor, I mean, he's following a model. He's not inventing it. This is the model that's there.
Exactly.
Find, in a way, his egotism is worthwhile, isn't it? Because, or it's justified. I always find it amazing that when he returns to France in 1815 off the island of Elba, It's very interesting when you look at declarations of war and cease and sort of ends of wars. And the declaration of war was not against France, because the allies were not at war with France. France, for them, was a country they were allied with and that was run by, you know, Louis the Fat. They declared war specifically on the person of Napoleon. And I'm not sure that's ever happened before in history. So the Battle of Waterloo is not really a battle of England and Prussia against France. It's a battle of England, Prussia, Russia, and everyone else against Napoleon. And in a sense, you've got to almost admire and be horrified by the fact that a person could be that momentous in world history to inspire that reaction.
Yeah, but I mean, again, it's like, that's what it was. And that's why we still talk about this guy today, because that's what happened. To talk a little bit more about the battles, and this is my final reaction to the film. And as you already mentioned, how Ridley Scott chose to focus on the relationship with Josephine and the battles, and how those two work together to create, to me, this ultimately very sad, tragic story, is, I mean, the sheer futility of the battles as they go on and on and on. And then when you get to Waterloo and you just see, what the heck are these people doing? They're just standing there shooting at each other. And this is, you know, again, this is a turn in history of how war did change, that, you know, for a long time it was all these people standing in line and shooting each other and just dying. And
like, let's send horses against the men or vice versa. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Yes, the cavalry charges that are just so brutal, and yeah, they look beautiful and they're gallant, etc. Yeah, but it's
fucking
also
savage.
Really
and
horrific.
I think this film shows that very well. Like, they do show, as in that amazing Sergei Bondarchuk War and Peace. There's a very nice sequence in Waterloo where they show the infantry marching down the hill in line, and then as the cavalry is charging up to meet them, they form square. So the kind of that was the modern version of the old Roman testudo, I guess, with spears out. Or bayonets out in the square, which was seen as the only effective way to sort of counter a cavalry charge. But it is just savage. And can you imagine being in the front line of that infantry part of the square with a cavalry coming up, charging up against you? It must have been absolutely petrifying. And yet this was done again and again and again and again. This was just standard warfare of the time, right?
So. Exactly. And very briefly, I hope, again, you know, our hopes for the extended cut, when they are in Russia, and we do see those, I don't know if they were supposed to be Cossacks, or they were some kind of part of the larger Russian Empire. Guerrilla forces. And you see that very brief moment of guerrilla warfare, which is one of the ways the Revolutionary War in America was won. Sorry, Bina. we still get to lord that over you guys. Okay, I'm done. But
how's that working out for you? You're about to re-elect President Trump. I mean, maybe you would be better off keeping the kings and queens.
Hey, look, like one of my favorite history teachers in high school said, this is an experiment and the jury's still out on us. And I keep that in mind constantly. But still, you know, seeing that moment of this could be done differently. And even, you know, luring them all the way into Moscow, and then the burning of Moscow was so cool. That was so cool.
Oh my goodness, yeah, hilarious. Yeah. I mean, Ridley Scott also can't resist going too far. So just the sheer amount of pigeon shit he had on that Russian throne, just hilarious.
that was so cool. But like, yeah, just showing how they could not believe that a ruler and his people would do this. And it's like, yeah, man, you don't, I'm not gonna, well, I mean, the Russians today, well, you know, it's like, it's not so much the Russian people as it is Putin, but you know, it's like, yeah, these are hardcore people. But truly at the time, it was an unbelievable thing that people did. And it's funny because when they were showing, you know, the skyline of Moscow, I've been to Moscow, I've toured the Kremlin, and being able to just see some of those buildings, you know, over the skyline, I was like, oh, I've been in that church. That's cool. And then just remembering what's coming, and it's like, oh yeah, that's right. And then they burned it all.
And it's very well done, isn't it? I mean, like, this really is a film where I think CGI is used in the best possible way.
Exactly,
the way it's used in the battles, the way it's used to recreate Moscow, the way it's used to create some of the detail and savagery of the battle scenes involving people and animals. I think It really is phenomenal. And it kind of makes me sad that they didn't go to the point of anti-aging or de-aging Joaquin Phoenix, because evidently they did it very well. But this is how Ridley Scott can shoot a film like that in 60 days. I mean, it's insane. He shot this in 60 days. Oh,
okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow. So, okay. All right. Well,
and the whole de-aging would have slowed it down hugely, right? Which is probably why they chose not to do it. I mean, this is a feat of filmmaking by a man who was in his early 80s. And is now filming Gladiator 2. I mean, this is a man who is at arguably the peak of his powers right now. It's quite something.
Yeah, yeah. Those are things we have to keep in mind. But by the end of the movie, just all this pointless death. For what? You know, and then, you know, bringing us to the end of the film where at this point, you know, Josephine has died. She did predecease him. And then he is on St. Helena. And we have this really, you know, fun interaction of him. And he did spend his last years like writing. And again, this is one of the reasons we know so much is he spent all this time writing and reflecting and going over what happened and leaving his accounts of what happened.
Yeah.
And there's these two girls. I mean, like not even boys, these two girls who it's like, you know, the future is female. I mean, like we're all, it's like, for me, that was a little moment of seeing how society is going to change. We're moving into the era that we recognize today. So these two girls are stick fighting, and he's like, hey, do you know who burned Moscow? Like, the Russians did. He's like, no, that was me. And they're like, no, it wasn't. And they go back to stick fighting. You know, I think that's lovely,
isn't it? Because he's trying to propagandize. And I think it's a beautifully elegant, very sweet way for Ridley Scott to show, he's writing his version of history right now, and this is going to be contested. So it's almost Ridley Scott saying, don't even go there in terms of, we know there are interpretations, this is mine, there are others. Yes. I think maybe not Ridley Scott, maybe it's the screenwriter David Scarfer, but I think it's a very elegant closing. I really do.
Yes, very much. And really just showing like, even at the time it was contested. People were trying to contest it at least. But, you know, then it brings for me that what was the dual tragedy of the story of the movie was, you know, him thinking about Josephine and, you know, and that beautiful voiceover by Vanessa Kirby saying, you know, this time I'm going to be the emperor and you're going to listen to me. And then, and it's time for you to come to me. And we just see him at the end, you know, that shot of him behind with the hat. And then he just sort of collapses to one side.
Yeah.
And that's very moving. Yes. So then we get the card explaining the death tolls, as you already mentioned. And then you have a final death toll of about 3 million people. So, you know, from the way it hit me in that moment, sitting in the theater, was we have the macro and the micro, the macro tragedy of all this death, which, you know, again, at the end, as you pointed out, was senseless. And just the way that warfare was done, just, you know, throwing so many people just at each other so pointlessly, so brutally. And then the micro tragedy of this couple who only figured their shit out when it was too late.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so,
and it was a love story. It genuinely was. Mm-hmm. It was a very quirky, weird love story, but it certainly was mm-hmm. one. And, you know, between two rather damaged people in many ways. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's amazing. I think talking through this with you, which I've enjoyed greatly, has almost made me appreciate the film more than my initial disappointment on the lack of politics and some of the comedy and the way some of the choices were done. It's really made me remember the individual things that I loved about it so much. We need to reunite after the extended cut to reconsider that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. But for me, the takeaway, like, and as you already pointed out, the battles, the love story. So again, that was for me, the big picture, and then this tragedy of two people who, you know, the potential of them figuring out how they wanted to actually be together as a married couple passed them by.
Absolutely.
And that's really sad. You know, I mean, it's that famous quote from Gone Girl, two people who love each other who can't figure out how to be together. That's the real tragedy. I wanted to say the other thing I did wanted to hit on before we wrap up is just how gorgeous this movie was visually. Mm. You know, it's a dude's rock movie. It's an aesthetic movie. The costumes, the fact that, I mean, so many of the places where this action happened still exists in France and throughout Europe, and they were able to film there. And what really hit me was a lot of the military costumes, these gorgeous sashes the men were wearing, the brocade, that really, you know, that brings you into the painting, you know, like you felt like you were in one of these epic paintings.
They recreate the coronation painting. And I mean, I don't know who the costume designer was, the production designer, the art direction. This film is stunning. And I think we should close by encouraging people, as much as we've talked about the extended cut, to say, you know, this is by no means a perfect film. I think you loved it probably more than me. But nonetheless, I would encourage you, if you have any interest in history and battles and costume, to go see this in the cinema. It really will repay being seen on a big screen. Not every film does. Some of them you can watch perfectly well at home. But I think this is the film that if you can, please go to the cinema to see it, because those battle sequences, the costumes, everything just really repays that time and money investment.
And also just being able to appreciate the acting done by Joaquin Phoenix and Vanessa Kirby.
Mm.
To really appreciate what they're putting in there. And
an honorable mention to Rupert Everett as the Duke of Wellington.
Oh my God.
Having the time of his life.
Oh my God, that was so good. You think you're so great because you have boats. Sorry, Napoleon, that was true. that is how it worked out. But I mean, I would love to see that line becoming as iconic as in the quirky movie line lexicon as, you know, from
I think it already has. I think it's become meanable. I mean, like the screening I was watching, there were two lines that got laughs, and the first I think took us all out of the film. It's when Vanessa Kirby says, "There's this thing under here, and once you've seen it, you'll never go back." I think everyone's like, "Oh God, that's just like that's appalling. That's just not worked." And then the line about the boats, I think, was brilliant because it showed the infantilization of Napoleon, that he is just a pissed off 3-year-old who's throwing a tantrum and it's going to result in Europe war, you know? Apparently that was Joaquin Phoenix's idea to put that line.
Oh my God, I love that. But it also really, to me, encapsulated that conflict of the era, you know, because that's why, you know, because Britain was the naval power and France was the land power.
The land power, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. And right there, it was right there, you know, and then of course, you know, and Rule Britannia, the sun never sets on the British Empire.
And that was true, right? I mean, like at the end of the day, the Battle of Waterloo, yes, England was on the winning side, but it was on the winning side only because, and the film does bring this up very well. I was nervous that Ridley would make a jingoistic, hey, the Brits defeated France single-handedly, but it absolutely shows you that it was utterly contingent on the Prussians turning up, that this was a combined allied effort, and it was by the skin of their teeth. Wellington was in probably 45 minutes of defeat, and it's only because the Prussians turned up that the tide was turned. Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this. Tune back in for our extended edition sort of like commentary. And join us on the Battles of King's Grave Discord server for more Napoleonic nerdy chat.
Yes. And going over great cinematic battles of history. Okay, like what's better, Battle of the Bastards or Agincourt from Kenneth Branagh's Henry V? Quick, which one? Have I had that discussion? Yes.
Exactly. All right. Great to chat to you, Julia. Have a good one.
Yeah. Okay, bye.